September 30th, 2025, Bhagiri Monastery, Half Moon Wanpra, Lunar Observance Day, the waxing moon, heading toward the full moon, the end of the Vasa in a week, the Pavarana Day. So that is the marks the end of the Vasa. Technically, the Vasa ends at the next dawn after that. And also, just to mention, because there might be some new guests here and people who are new to the monastery, that when we take the eight precepts on the Lunar Observance Day, it's not a long-term binding thing. It's just for a day and a night. And it's also for people living in the monastery for a period of time to renew and reaffirm that they're following the eight precepts while they're here. And also the precepts are very interesting in that when we have in the eight precepts, we have the third precept, which we call the brahmacharya, which is complete celibacy, not being able to fulfill ourselves in any sexual way at all while we're in the monastery. And that creates a sacred space, sacred ground. And that's what creates the good feeling here. I believe that that is one of the main things. So when people come to the monastery, people are drawn to the monastery because they feel good here. They feel safe here. And I've even heard people say that there's a certain point on Tomkai Road when approaching the monastery where they feel the energy shift. And so over time, that builds up into sacred ground. And then you have the fourth precept, which is not to lie. And so that also helps protect all the other precepts. Because if we end up breaking a precept and trying to hide it, then that's dishonest. So that fourth precept then protects all the other precepts. So, and then we have confession, which isn't quite the same as confession in Christianity, where you go to a little kiosk and there's somebody inside to listen to your confession. But confession just means making it known, telling somebody. And also the precepts are training guidelines. They're not commandments per se. They're something that if you break a precept, then having made it known, having told somebody, either someone you trust as a teacher or a Dhamma friend, then you redetermine to try to keep that precept better in the future. So those eight precepts, when taken in the monastery on the Lunar Observance Day, it's to be committed to for a day and a night. So at tea time, we were discussing some interesting topics about the suttas and perhaps past Buddhas, future Buddhas, certain things in the suttas that sometimes we might see things in the suttas that don't necessarily make sense in terms of what we know about evolution or human history or anthropology as we have it. And I think that's fine. We can just set those things aside. Or there might be certain things in the suttas if we consider ourselves to be somebody who, say, believes that everything in the Buddha's life story is allegorical and it's all just metaphors with certain meanings. That's also fine. And if we take it more literally, that's okay too. Whatever is helpful for us, whatever works for us. So if you don't believe that when the Bodhisattva was born, that he stood on the ground and took seven steps, and under each step a lotus appeared under his feet, and then he put one finger up and said, "I am foremost in the world, I will attain the foremost." That's fine if you don't believe that. And if you're a faith type like me, then of course, how could it be any other way? But if you believe that maybe the seven lotuses, that they symbolize certain things, symbolize the giving up of greed, hatred, and delusion, or the development of the seven factors of awakening. So there are these various explanations. So these things could have deeper meanings, or it could be both. It could be literal and allegorical. I think that's also a valid interpretation. It could have actually happened as some sort of miraculous thing. There are, I've heard stories of babies, very, very, very rare, but babies that can speak as soon as they're born and then they stop, like they'll say something and then they won't speak for another 14 months or so. But very, very rare, but not unheard of. So I think it's good to be open to these types of things. And also even a newborn baby, I learned this in living in the northeast of Thailand. They do a thing with their babies to strengthen their legs. They can hold their feet. A parent will hold their baby's feet in one hand and the baby will stand, even if it's newborn. So there is a way to do these. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. Just have to be kind of open to these things. Or we might think of like the whole cosmological millions and millions of years of Buddhas, and how could that be possible? So I think that's fine to just use it as a reflection, as a contemplation, but really then coming back to the moment, coming back to just this experience of this body and mind and all the other Dhamma teachings. There's a lot of very interesting stories around the Buddha. So we have this sutta where Ananda, Venerable Ananda, is waxing lyrically about all of the wonderful and marvelous qualities of the Buddha, of the Tathagata, and he's talking to the other monks about it, and he's saying that the Buddha has this these wonderful and marvelous qualities. When he was born, he took seven steps, and so on, and then after his birth, there were these prophecies, and then he had these this or that amazing thing, miraculous thing that he did throughout his life, and then the Buddha walks in and says, what were you speaking about? Ananda relates all these things, and the Buddha says, yes, all of those are perhaps true, but do you want to know another wonderful and marvelous quality about the Tathagata? And yes, Lord, yes. He says, well, when a feeling arises, the Tathagata knows a feeling has arisen. When a feeling persists, Tathagata knows the feeling persists. When it passes away, he knows it passes away. When a perception arises, he knows a perception has arisen. When a perception persists, he knows a perception persists. When a perception passes away, he knows a perception passes away. When a thought arises, he knows a thought has arisen. When a thought persists, he knows it is persisting. When it passes away, he knows it passes away. This is also another wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. So that's the Buddha makes a point of adding that in as something which is to be paid attention to. Or there's another place where he says, from the moment of the Tathagata's awakening until his final parinibbana, everything he utters, everything he says is just so and not otherwise, and is completely unmistaken. So, and the end of suffering, to end suffering is considered a certain type of power that we can develop. So there's the divine eye, being able to see other realms of existence, being able to see our past lives and so on. That is something that can be developed. But also beyond that is the ending of the taints, the ending of the defilements. That's also considered a psychic power that can be developed that's much more lofty. And I remember being with Lungpa Liam, not this last time, but a previous visit when he was here in 2018. And we were in his kuti with him in the evening time, just spending some time with him. And somebody asked, you know, I want to develop psychic powers. How do you develop psychic powers? And Lungpa Liam quickly said, there's only one psychic power that you need to develop, and that's the power to end suffering. So that's the important one. That's the one we want to look at. And there are also these wonderful and marvelous psychic powers that can be developed in terms of, there's a whole stock phrase, one can walk on water as if it were earth, swim in the earth as if it were water, fly up and touch the sun and the moon, and even go up to the Brahma realms and know the minds of others and so on. So these are called the psychic power of miraculous powers. There's the psychic power of mind reading, and then there's the miraculous power of being able to teach others and guide others. And the Buddha says the third one is more profound and more useful than the first two. So to be able to actually say things which will help others in their practice and ultimately help to liberate others or free others from suffering, that is considered an ability that is more profound than the first two. So it's not that the first two are easy to develop. Those are considered, according to, you hear about stories and lore about these things in Thailand, and they're incredibly difficult to develop. And it also is incredibly difficult to say things which might actually profoundly change the mind of somebody else. You have these stories of the Buddha with Angulimala, or Longpo Cha with the assassin that was sent to kill him at Wat Phapong. That was mentioned that in a talk not too long ago, where somebody who we don't know who hired an assassin to go to Wat Phapong and pose as a guest, and actually with the intention to assassinate Longpo Cha. And part of it was learning Longpo Cha's daily schedule, and then eventually part of the daily schedule is listening to a Dhamma talk by Longpo Cha, and this person ended up developing faith in Longpo Cha and gave back the contract and went back to Wat Phapong and ordained and never disrobed, died in the robes. So somebody of great spiritual power like Longpo Cha can do that, can change somebody like that, can actually change the mind of another person, and actually flip the mind of another person. Angulimala, the Buddha, could actually flip his mind completely on end from being a killer to being somebody who completely gives that up, and the mind goes completely into the wholesome. It flips on end and turns around completely. So that can happen. That is a possibility. And you have even stories in the Tibetan traditions of hunters coming across yogis and developing faith in them and becoming yogis themselves and developing really strong meditation practice, and the mind becoming incredibly bright and wholesome. So we hear these stories. This really is possible. And for anybody who lives in the monastery for any period of time, you see that progression happening as well. And for ourselves, sometimes we don't see it in ourselves because it happens very slowly, slowly and imperceptibly. But then, say for myself, as I watch a lot of Anagarikas, novices, bhikkhus, and so on, there is a progression that happens. And junior monks becoming Majjhima, middling monks, and Ajahns, and so on. There is a maturation, a progression that happens for everybody who sticks with it, who sticks with the precepts, follows just the daily schedule of meditation, taking the meal, engaging in dana, wholesome activities, generosity, kindness, learning about how to forgive, learning about how to live with each other, how to let go of one's views and opinions, and so on. We do that for a long period of time, and then the mind, the heart becomes bright and wieldy, malleable, fit for work. Something that came up at tea time also, I was relating some stories about what can happen when you come to the monastery and actually ordain, that we eat every day next to the same person. So we might start to develop aversion toward the eating habits of the person next to us, for example. And I used the example in the past, there was somebody who was sitting next to another. It was two novices, actually, and one had developed aversion to the other, the way the other one was eating lettuce each day. And it's kind of just kind of a mannerism. The other person had to take a long piece of lettuce and kind of ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. And the person sitting next to him would go into rage when this would happen. And we might think, oh, that would never happen to me. I could never do, you know, I could never have that ridiculous of a mental state. But actually, it's not sure. You can't predict. You can't predict that wouldn't happen to you. So it is just part of the path. It's a progression. It's just a phase. It's just a phase. It'll pass. So it's like, you know, parents say, oh, he's just going through a phase. So it is just a phase. And if it isn't too much suffering to the point that one actually leaves the monastery, in this case it was. In this case it was too much suffering. But if one can stick with it and endure that thing, then yes, we do come out of it. And then we can laugh about ourselves later on. Oh, that's pretty funny. How could I have gotten into those mental states? And it's just the mind. The mind, when the mind is empty, it's like a vacuum. It'll cling to the closest thing possible. If we don't yet have wisdom, then we'll let go of one thing. We might be able to let go of one thing. The mind's just going to grab onto something else. It's not going to be able to let go of everything. We let go of one thing, it's going to grab something else. Then over time, over time, there's a gradual progression, a gradual deepening. And the Buddha said the practice over time is like the land going into the sea. He said it's a gradual deepening. He said it doesn't just drop off right away. It's a gradual deepening. It gets gradually deeper and deeper, and then maybe eventually it drops off really far out in the ocean. And there's always this, there's this debate I've heard about of in the Mahayana, is it gradual enlightenment or sudden enlightenment? So are you a gradual enlightenment type or a sudden enlightenment type? And when Master Xu Yun, some of you may have read about, when he was, he's the Master Xuanhua's teacher who lived to be 120 and passed away in 1959, considered one of the greatest bhikkhus of any tradition in the past few hundred years. And when he was asked this question, he said, somebody asked, is it gradual enlightenment or sudden enlightenment? And he said, well, for a really long time, you gradually practice and then suddenly it happens. So really like that answer. So we come back to just reflecting on these basic things, or just our experience. How are we experiencing things? How are we reacting to things? We need to be very forgiving with ourselves. If we do go into rage at the person next to us eating lettuce, you know, it's okay. We can be forgiving with ourselves, that we just can't control it yet. We have to look at that feeling of irritation, that feeling of frustration, and what is behind it, you know, what's actually fueling it. And the interesting thing about practice is we're empowered to do something about it. We're generating this somehow. It's not the other person. Our suffering is not coming from outside. If it was just coming from outside, then there's nothing we can do about it. If we think our suffering is coming from somewhere else other than inside of us, and that we're suffering because of this or that situation in the world, then there's nothing we can do about it. We're completely disempowered if that was really the case, but that is not the case. The truth of the Buddha's teachings is that the suffering is coming from inside and we're generating it. How are we generating it? We're generating it with our reactions to certain situations. And our reactions to certain situations are going to be conditioned by a reference point that is deep in the heart. It's very hard to see. It's like, this is like the conjurer's trick. So the reference point is like the director. It's the director that's directing the attention in certain ways. There's a hidden director. And the director or the reference point is what we would refer to as the atta, or the sense of self. The sense of self is a reference point. And that reference point is one part of the engine that drives samsara. And the other point that drives samsara that works with it is desire. So ignorance and desire are, you could say, they're the parents of the matrix. The parents of samsara. And those two things working together, then they generate all sorts of, they direct our attention in certain ways. And when our attention is directed in certain ways, then that gives rise to certain perceptions and feelings. And this is the whole Paticca-samuppada as well. We could think of it as the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths is just a summary of Paticca-samuppada. It's just a summary of dependent origination. The Four Noble Truths is a simplified version, which is perhaps easier to think about, easier to contemplate. That there is suffering, there is a cause of suffering, which is tanha. There's an ending of suffering, which is the relinquishment of tanha. There's the path leading to being able to do that, the Noble Eightfold Path, which we chanted this evening. So with this ignorance and craving, this engine that drives samsara, then to look at that and investigate it and see that this is something that's coming from inside. It's the sankhara that is creating the objects which we cling to and suffer over. So the whole engine is created from us, from the inside. That there are objects of attention that we suffer over. Either we want something and we aren't able to get it, or we are averse to something and we come into contact with it. These things we suffer over, but it's the sankhara actually creating those things. Those things don't exist in and of themselves. We're imputing existence onto things, and then we're imputing like and dislike onto things, and then the desire gets involved, and then it's a whole big mess. It's a hot mess. I've learned this term recently. It's a hot mess. It's a whole big mess. And Lompar Ban refers to it as the mess maker. So there's the mess maker in the heart, and if we don't get the mess maker out of the heart, then the mess maker is just going to keep going around making messes. So we need to look at this, but it's subtle stuff. How this, it seems so convincing that it's coming from outside. It's so convincing that if it just wasn't this way, then I would be happy. But actually, according to the law of karma, then everything is exactly as it should be in the moment. If we reflect on karma, we can give rise to equanimity. That's actually supposed to be the way to develop equanimity, is to reflect on karma. And the reflection on karma would say that everything I'm experiencing right now is exactly as it should be according to all the causes and conditions that are in place at this moment. That are, I'm receiving the fruits of all sorts of past intentions and ways I've used my attention and everything I've done in public and private and so on. I'm receiving the results of those now. And if it's suffering that I'm receiving, then there's something I can do about that. How am I using my attention? What am I paying attention to? Can I shift that? Can I train that in a way that's going to lessen the suffering? We can give rise to a base of equanimity just by reflecting that everything right now is exactly as it should be, whether it's suffering or happiness or just a sense of indifference, whether we're comfortable or uncomfortable. This is all exactly as it should be in the moment. So when we reflect on these things, it should be enough to give us a sense that we can practice, we can have a say in how we move forward in our lives, we can make things better. And it's really up to us. It's really up to how we're going to use our attention, how we're going to use our sense of focus, how we're going to relate to the precepts, and whether we're going to be able to pick up and practice and follow the Noble Eightfold Path and try to follow it as long as we can, and even to completion if we can. And the suttas and the chanting that we do and everything, it's all just a map. And so becoming an expert in the map or just studying the map is good. It's a very good thing. It's a good thing to know the map and memorize the map. But then actually traveling on the path, when you get in your car and drive, it's not the same as the map. It's not the same as just looking at a map. It's completely different. So we could say that actually walking the path and practicing is completely different than just reading the suttas. We could say it's completely different than just doing the chanting or the reflections. Because when we actually walk the path and we try to live in the way that's taught in the suttas and taught by the Kripa Ajahns, then only then will we be able to experience it for ourselves. And the suttas and the teachings aren't going to tell us where there's going to be some sort of obstacle across the road that we have to go around, or our car might break down at some point and we have to walk for a while, or there might be some sort of weather event that we're not expecting. So the map won't show us those things, those unforeseens. It's only going to show us a basic framework of move in this direction and go this way, go that way until the destination. So the map is important, but also we're going to have to develop a sense of patience and resourcefulness along the journey. And just to keep that in mind, develop a long, enduring mind, a mind that can get through these suffering that we're inevitably going to experience along the way. And then when things happen, like we get irritated or frustrated with somebody, or we get upset with ourselves for not being able to follow certain aspects of the path in the moment, then we'll be able to actually, with that long enduring mind, we'll be able to keep going. We'll be able to just pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, keep going. And as long as we keep walking forward, as long as we don't give up, we're good. We're still moving in the right direction. The only real failure is if we give up. If we don't give up, there's going to be all sorts of failures and mistakes along the way. But ultimately, if we don't give up, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep moving forward. If we keep practicing, we can't not get the results, because that wouldn't be in line with the law of karma. The results have to come if we do those wholesome actions. So these are a few reflections coming up this evening. I think that's enough for appropriate for the amount of time. If I keep going or say too much, then you might not remember some pertinent points. So I think I'll just leave it there for now.